From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our series on the body and the mind with a focus on the head. First, we'll examine why we're plagued by memory lapses and find it so hard to remember everything we need to keep track of. We'll hear from neurologist Dr. Barry Gordon. He runs the memory clinic at Johns Hopkins University. Then we'll find out why our heads hurt. We'll hear about the latest research into headaches, their causes and treatments, with Dr. Fred Cheftel, co-founder of the New England Center for Headache. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton was the main attraction at last night's session of the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Mrs. Clinton outlined her husband's policies and goals in her speech. She also shot back at Bob Dole, who'd criticized her for saying, "It takes a village to raise a child." Dole had said Republicans believe it takes a family to do that. Mrs. Clinton had this response.
Of course, parents first and foremost are responsible for their children, but we are all responsible for ensuring that children are raised in a nation that doesn't just talk about family values, but acts in ways that values families.
Thousands of tickets for President Clinton's appearance in Kalamazoo, Michigan today have been given away through the state's Democratic Party, but some of the people picking up tickets are unlikely supporters of the president. Gordon Evans of member station WMUK in Kalamazoo reports.
Jackie England, a senior citizen going back to college, says she was a Republican who voted for Ross Perot in 1992. But England says she will be there when President Clinton speaks in Kalamazoo and plans to vote for him this fall.
He didn't win me over as much as the Republican Party pushed me out, particularly their stand against raising the minimum wage.
Even though Southwest Michigan is a traditional Republican stronghold, President Clinton narrowly carried the area in 1992. Local Democratic candidates are counting on the president's appearance to give them a boost in November. For National Public Radio, this is Gordon Evans in Kalamazoo, Michigan.
South Korean riot police detained scores of students today after conducting raids on several college campuses across the country. The BBC's Charles Scanlon has more.
In pre-dawn raids, 12,000 riot police moved onto 23 university campuses across South Korea. The national news agency Yonhap said 340 students were detained in the operation, and it said large numbers of steel pipes and firebombs were confiscated, as well as pamphlets and other literature. A police spokesman said they were looking for students involved in last week's disturbances around Yonsei University in Seoul, the most violent clashes between police and students for several years. The government has promised to break up the radical students' union that organized the protests and has already closed down its offices on a number of campuses. Government officials have described the group as a terrorist organization waging a guerrilla war, and they accuse its leaders of being North Korean sympathizers. The students themselves say they want to put pressure on the government to improve the currently frozen relations between North and South Korea.
Charles Scanlon reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 10 points at 5720. This is NPR. There are accusations against the government in the Oklahoma City bombing trial. The lawyer for defendant Timothy McVeigh says federal officials haven't turned over intelligence reports that the defense was promised months ago. Attorney Stephen Jones says the government has intelligence reports suggesting Iraq may have sponsored last year's attack. Prosecutors insist there is no evidence of any foreign involvement in the bombing, but Jones has asked a federal judge to order the government to share the reports anyway. Pelicans are dying in record numbers at the Salton Sea National Wildlife Refuge, about 100 miles east of San Diego. The largest die-off ever may be traced to contaminated fish. Nancy Greenlease of member station KPBS reports from San Diego.
The illegal use of pesticides may be linked to the deaths of thousands of birds at Salton Sea. white and brown pelicans, and 30 other types of birds are dying from botulism after eating fish carcasses. But officials from the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife say that the fish may have been killed by pesticides used on farmland south of the sea. The fish died in July and sank to the bottom of nearby channels. A recent severe thunderstorm churned the waters and brought the fish carcasses and contaminated maggots to the surface. Sick birds were observed the next day. Over 3,000 have died since mid-August. That's close to half of Salton Sea's bird population. Nearly 600 of the endangered California brown pelicans have perished. For National Public Radio, I'm Nancy Greenlees in San Diego.
Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat has called for a four-hour general strike tomorrow in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and in Gaza. It's in response to what he calls a declaration of war by Israel's new government. The strike call is Arafat's most serious challenge to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to date. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today, as we continue our series on the body and mind, we focus on the mind, more specifically on memory. Many of us are plagued by memory lapses. We forget the names of people we know, forget to make important phone calls, forget what we were about to say, and can't even remember if we locked the door after leaving the house. Oops, better go back and check. Neurologist Dr. Barry Gordon says there are explanations for many of these memory lapses. He's the director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University and author of the book Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life. Earlier this summer, he told Fresh Air guest host Marty Moscoane that our brains are not really designed to process, store, and retrieve all the information that bombards us daily.
Our brains are not like little pocket notebooks, unfortunately. They weren't designed to handle lists of names and numbers. And they also weren't designed to juggle so many things at once or take in information from so many different channels that's competing with itself. You may be seeing something that says one thing. You may be hearing something that says another while you're even driving along doing something entirely different. And that isn't something that's very natural for us. And as a result, one of the most common complaints I hear is that people think their memory's slipping, but what they're really doing is not being able to pay attention. They're not able to capture it as it's running on by them because their brains weren't designed to grab it and hold it the way a tape recorder or VCR could.
Well, what kind of a world are our brains designed for and our memories designed for?
Well, it looks like our brains and our memories were designed for the world we inhabited about 40 to 100,000 years ago when... or a little bit before that time, when our anatomically modern ancestors were being formed or selected out. And as far as we can tell, that was a world of mostly hunter-gatherers. People would go out and hunt, find whatever food is near you, grab it for the day, maybe put in a little reserve, but not a lot. It was a world where probably groups of people were no more than 40 or 50. And every once in a while, you wander around, get together, meet up with a larger group, but you wouldn't have to remember more than 40 or 50 people well in your lifetime, because that's all you'd ever see. You'd have to remember important things like where trees were, what direction you were going in, and how to come back from a hunt and not get lost. But you certainly wouldn't have to remember your zip plus four, or your PIN, or your Social Security number, or the 1,000th person you just met at a party.
Let me ask you then to take us through the brain process that takes an event and then stores it as memory. What happens in the brain?
Well, there's really three basic processes at first to think about. One is getting it in, because not everything that runs by us and the outside world gets inside of our head. So while you think you're seeing a lot, you're not seeing everything that happens. While you think you're hearing a lot, you're not hearing everything that happens. What gets into your head is partly determined by what you want to be there and what you expect to be there. If I suddenly switch to a foreign language, not much would get inside your head, even though, of course, the sounds are still there, because you just wouldn't have any way of capturing it. And that's an important point, because people only perceive what they already know about. And people don't realize that you can't see things that you're not very familiar with, or you can't see them very well or understand them very well. So that's point number one. You have to get it in. The next step inside your head is you hold it there for a little bit. If it's sounds, you can hold them there for a couple of seconds. If it's sights, they get erased very quickly within about a half a second when a new sight comes in. Then you can make, in a sense, a decision. Should you keep it or should you throw it away? If you decide to keep it, you begin to burn it into the wiring of the brain. And there's a lot of processes at work there, but they all go under the term long-term memory. And what you've been doing now is converting from something immediate, memory, to a longer-term memory. You've been hardening it, gluing it down, cementing it. The reason you decide to keep something inside your head that way may be because you've heard it a lot, it's been repeated, or because it's important to you, so that the brain mechanism says, look, even though this has only happened once, this is awfully important, I've got to lock it in. And important to you can mean intellectually important or can mean emotionally important, so a scary episode, fear, taste, hunger, or desire, like I better learn this for the test kind of thing. Now, once you've gotten it locked inside your head, there's still another step involved in a memory, which is getting it out again.
Right.
Because very little of what we need to remember gets presented to us on a silver platter exactly the way we learned it. You know, that's part of the old trick in high school and college. You know, give the test question a little differently than they were taught it. And what that means is you've got to figure out from what you've been asked to remember the information you have in your head that might answer that question and come up with the best match. And we do those both automatically. There's an automatic search process that goes on where lots of different related thoughts light up. And there's also a conscious search process, which you know about because you say, who did I sit next to in third grade? Let me see. It was next to Bobby. Who was, oh, that's it. And then you can go through that process mentally and you know it's conscious. But a lot of the parts of that process are unconscious. And those three stages make up memory for us.
Most people cannot remember the first couple of years of their life and get bits and pieces, fragments of early memories going back to maybe when they're 3 or 4 or 5 years old. Is the development of memory then tied to the development of language?
Well, that particular part of it probably is. There's lots of reasons why kids can't remember. You can't remember being a kid.
Right.
One is you don't have a lot of experience. You don't have a lot of those slots I mentioned in which to put things. You know, everything's brand new, and so it's hard to remember. Secondly, it's very possible that the brain mechanisms for saving information are not very mature. Kids, of course, do have memories. Everybody who's shown a kid a Reese's peanut butter cup and then come back a little while later knows that the kid has a memory for it. But it's not as strong as it would be for an adult. They take a little longer to learn. But you hit on it, Marty. The most important thing is probably other things develop. And language is one of the most important things to develop. And memories that you have before you have language are just not saved the same way. And they get overwritten. They get crowded out by the language-based memories that come later. And all the other hopefully nice things that happen to you as you grow up, too.
Well, do scientists know why some people remember more or better or even more vividly than other people?
Well, we know why. I mean, collectively, we know why. But in any individual, it's hard to tell. We think that one reason why people have different memories is because their brains are different and their chemistry is different. There are so many different chemicals involved in saving memories that you and I may differ in them just like you and I may differ in whether we have blue or brown eyes or dark or blonde hair or what have you. And it may make a difference in how we save different kinds of memories in different parts of our brain. And those are probably differences we're born with. There's another difference that you and I have, which is gender.
Right.
And that probably is responsible for both intrinsic differences in the brain and also later differences in hormones that change the way we save information. And then there's finally differences in interest and culture. You and I grew up interested in different things. We were encouraged to be interested in different things. We decided to be interested in different things. And we developed different aspects of our memory. And those three reasons are probably why people differ so much in their memories, even though many people aren't aware of how different people's memories are. They are vastly different.
What can you tell us about how men and women remember differently?
Well, I can tell you a bit about how men and women remember differently, but we're not sure it's because they're men or women versus men or women in our society, which is a big difference. There's a suspicion that the real sex differences between men and women are in a kind of mechanical memory and a kind of space memory, so that men are better than women in finding their way across large distances, whereas women are better than men in finding their way around more smaller spaces, more local spaces. And that's been thought by many people to represent something biologic, coming back from the 40 to 100,000 years ago when I mentioned before, because men were asked to go out and hunt, if you like, and it may not be so hard to go out and hunt, but finding your way back again is a big problem. And if you didn't have that skill, you rapidly got culled from the tribe. whereas women were typically the people who hunted and gathered near the village, near the settlement. And that meant you had to really know your territory very well. And it's thought that some of those differences show up in people today. However, most of the differences between men and women today seem to be not biologic, but cultural and interest.
Well, I don't know whether it's just the age of the people that I hang out with, whether it's friends or colleagues, most of them in their 40s and 50s. And a common complaint is the loss of memory, that they feel like they literally just can't remember things the way they used to when they were in their 20s and 30s. Is there a point in which the brain really just isn't working as efficiently when it comes to memory?
Well, the unfortunate news for all those who watch 30-something was that those people were already over the hill in terms of memory, or at least over the hump. But you know, among your friends, those complaints about memory may not mean that they actually have memory problems, at least coming from the brain. It is true that as we age, our mental processes get slower. And it is true that for some people in particular, our ability to form new memories gets worse. But for many people who are getting into their 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, the memory problems that we complain about are not necessarily because our memories are bad, but because they're misused or abused, I should say. So think about what also happens as you move from your 20s into your 40s. Your responsibilities change. You begin to get better at certain things, and you begin to get overwhelmed, perhaps, by others. You're juggling more things. And juggling all those things is a big problem for memory. When you actually test people who are older or complaining about memory problems, you often discover that their memory strength is perfectly adequate. It's just not up to the task they've given it, which is juggling, you know, spouse, home, kids, two jobs, whatever, and trying to get some relaxation in the middle of all that.
Well, it seems as if it's the little stuff that starts to go. I used to be a fairly good speller, and now I'm watching my spelling deteriorate. I had a friend say recently that they got into a car with a colleague. They looked over at them, and they couldn't remember their name, and they work with them just about every day. I mean, this is kind of nuts and bolts stuff that seems to be slowly evaporating.
Well, unfortunately, there is a little bit of that slow evaporation. It's not as bad as we might think if you measure it objectively, but it's certainly annoying. And some of it's definitely coming from the brain. Some of it's coming because, as I said, brain connections are slowing down. So that what the name that used to pop into your head in a quarter of a second before now takes half a second or three quarters of a second. And you can see, you can feel that difference. And it means that the mechanism jams because what it expects to happen on time isn't happening on time. The problem with reading, or spelling rather, is an interesting one because when you think about it, it may also be a case of not using it and so therefore losing it. Because we're really pushed in our spelling when we're younger. When we get older, we have a lot more props, and we may not push it anymore. And I don't know whether people are correcting your spelling the way they used to.
I hope not.
Maybe they don't want to mention anything to you.
That spell checker
helps too. Well, that's part of it. Some of that may be simply because we're letting some abilities atrophy a little bit. I mean, your ability to speak a foreign language is also dropping, but you never complained about that because you may not have been using it. I don't know in that case. The problem with names is an interesting one because names are just about, the inability to remember names is just about the most common complaint that people have. But they ought to take heart in a couple of things. One is that it's almost certain that ordinary people's inability to remember names means that they actually know those names somewhere, which is, of course, people's everyday experience. They know that person. They know what their name is. The moment they hear it, they'll be able to say it. And what's going on there, we think, is actually a traffic jam. It's because you know too much. You may think you're only looking at Brian sitting in the car, but in fact, you're thinking of all the other Brians you may have heard about, okay? And as a result, your memory has a traffic jam because it turns out there's only one exit. Only one name can slip through. And so you feel this jam. You know that you can unlock the jam if you hear sometimes the first couple of letters, okay, or the first sound, or if you walk away. If you walk away and stop thinking about it, what happens is everything begins to die down. The jam begins to thin out, and the one that's supposed to come out can slip on through because it's still the most important, the most active of all. So the people tend to block on the names of people they actually know reasonably well. People that you don't know hardly at all, well, you know why you don't know their name. And people that you know extremely well, they manage to make it through that traffic jam. It's only the people you know moderately well that you might block on.
Let's talk about an experience I know that everybody's had. We call it a déjà vu, that distinct feeling that something has happened before. And it feels obviously very familiar, but there's this little voice inside your head that says, well, this couldn't be happening. What's happening with the mind, with the brain on this?
What's happening is there's two voices inside your head. There's a feeling of familiarity that happens when you see something. Your mind instantly tries to compute, is this something I've seen before? But there's also the more detailed analysis your mind makes of whether that's actually something you've seen before. Does it connect with anything else in your mind accurately? What we think is going wrong in that feeling of deja vu is that little channel, that little highway that's familiarity, is tickling you. And you get the feeling, because of similarities of what you're seeing with what you've got already stored inside your head, that it is familiar. But of course, that other little voice that's saying, no, you didn't do it, it didn't happen, you haven't been here before, that's the voice of the other channel, the channel that's making the detailed comparison. And we're built like that probably for a good reason, because in a sense, one is the emergency channel. The quick one, you've got to decide real fast if that pattern of stripes moving in the underbrush is just your cat or a bigger cat that may not like you. And that other detailed one that we've acquired later. But it does mean that every once in a while, in fact, very frequently for people, they get this tickling feeling that's just wrong, and you have to use your reason to say no.
As part of our series on the body and the mind, we're featuring an interview with Dr. Barry Gordon, director of the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University. He spoke earlier this summer with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss Cohen. We'll hear more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to Marty Moss Cohen's interview about memory with neurologist Dr. Barry Gordon.
Can memory be trusted?
Well, yes and no. It depends on, it's like asking, can you trust your children? You can trust them up to a point, but I don't know if I'd completely trust them with the family jewels or fortune. You know, but sure, a dollar now and again is fine. The problem with our memories is that it's not perfect. Nobody's memory is perfect. Our memories, unlike computer memories, were not built to be perfect. They were built to make kind of creative errors, productive, informative errors, but errors nonetheless. So when I talk to Marty on Fresh Air, there's other Martys kind of crowding at the periphery of my mind that I might be not really confusing you with, but that memory is tickling and memory may be confusing with. Unlike a computer where every Marty is distinct, has a different slot on the hard drive. Now, the other problem with our memories, though, is that we judge how good our memories are by feeling a familiarity. How familiar does this feel? And unfortunately, even if you repeat something that's not true to yourself often enough, it'll become familiar to you. So that you'll suddenly begin to think, or not suddenly, you'll think, this is real. And that's how people can convince themselves. As a result of all this, as a result of the way that memory kind of molds itself around whatever's coming in and changes what's inside the memory store and how we don't always get it out of the memory the way it came in, the notorious, you know, passing along a message from one person to another type of effect, our memories can be trusted to get the gist of things relatively well, but the details often get shredded beyond belief. They're sometimes completely invented or modified. And we may not have the slightest clue that that's not right, because it feels right to us.
Is there such a thing as a photographic memory?
Well, there is such a thing as people who have fabulous memories in different areas. And there are such things as people who have memories that almost seem as though they save photographic images of what they look at. That happens more commonly in children than it does in adults, and for some reason it seems to fade as people get older, and it may be related to what we need as children versus what we need as adults, although it would be nice in our world to have a photographic memory. It turns out, though, that most of the people, if you advertise in the paper and you advertise for people with photographic or fabulous memories, most of the people who show up in response to such an ad have perfectly normal memories. But every once in a while, there's a person who either thinks of themselves as perfectly normal and they discover they have a fabulous memory, or who knows they have a fabulous memory but just hasn't been flaunting it very much, keeping it kind of as a secret weapon. And there are such people. In my book, I describe a number of those. There's a fellow who couldn't forget stories, for example. I mean, literally, he didn't try to forget them. He could remember them perfectly well, to the punctuation. Anything he read, he could remember. But there's a lesson in this, by the way, in those people with fabulous memories. They're not universally fabulous memories. People with photographic memories may have terrible memories in other areas. They may have memories that look almost as if they forgot to bring film in other areas of their life. So that the fellow who couldn't forget stories and who had a fabulous memory in other respects couldn't learn the names of people that he met very well. He was like you and me, or me at least in that respect. As he said, that's not the kind of thing I do. If I was a politician, maybe I'd do that, but I'm not, so I don't. And he was perhaps showing a combination of his own genetic endowment plus his own interest. And we're all like that. It's amazing, by the way, what kind of memory you can develop. Because one of the other lessons of people with so-called photographic memories or fabulous memories is that a lot of them are made, not born. By relentless practice, you can really, really, really improve your memory. I quoted the number of 40,000%. I'm basing that on the fact that, what, you can remember maybe four people at a party normally if you walk in. But there are known people. There are people who are known to be able to remember 400 people at once as they're introduced to them. And it can be done. However, to do that, you really have to work at it for many, many years. And most people will find that that degree of memory training, like being a weightlifter, isn't really useful in their everyday lives.
Have scientists figured out whether there is a connection between having a good memory and being intelligent?
Well, the evidence is having a good memory has nothing to do with being smart. While memory is spread out throughout the brain, there's not a single box that's memory. Being smart is different. It's using what memory you have in creative ways and anticipating and planning and everything else. And that actually has very little to do with memory. So it's very well known that there are people with fantastic memories who have only average IQs and other people who have super IQs whose memories are not very good by any standard at all.
Dr. Barry Gordon speaking earlier this summer with Fresh Air guest host Marty Moss-Cohen. He directs the Memory Clinic at Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Gordon's book, Memory, Remembering and Forgetting in Everyday Life, will be published in paperback in October. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, as we continue our series on the body and the mind, we examine the causes of headaches. We'll hear from Dr. Fred Chaptel, National President of AIC, the American Council for Headache Education. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Headaches. Sometimes they're just a mild throbbing that annoys you as you go about your daily business. Sometimes they hurt so much you have to give up and lie down. My guest, Dr. Fred Schaftel, is an expert on headaches, their causes, and treatment. He's the author of several books on the subject. His latest is Headache Relief for Women. Dr. Schaftel is co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and national president of AACE, the American Council for Headache Education. He says the latest research on migraines focuses on biochemical and electrical activity in the brain. For example, scientists are learning about the role of serotonin.
Serotonin is a biochemical that's found throughout the body and in the brain and seems to be a very, very important part of what's involved with migraine. There are many other chemical messengers or neurotransmitters that are involved, but a lot of focus has been on serotonin. Serotonin is a chemical that's available in the brain and is a neurotransmitter and seems to be disturbed in patients with migraine. It may either be a disturbance of the receptors themselves on nerve terminals or blood vessels, or it may be a disturbance in serotonin itself, the molecule. Well, there's a study that was just done in Europe by Dr. Diener and his group using a PET scan, which shows function of the brain. You see, CT scans and MRI scans show only structure. So in this particular examination, he looked at 8 or 9 migraine patients who were suffering acute attacks and saw this exact part of the brain light up and show excessive activity during the migraine attack. And when the migraine attack began to die down, so did this activity. So it's just confirming a lot of kind of hypothetical notions we've had based on our clinical evidence about what's going on with migraine. Some of the other advances are advances in outlining more of the receptors in the brain that are involved in migraine and some of the chemicals that are involved. There's a lot of advances in the area of molecular biology. There's been advances in the genetics of headache as well. So all these things together are just increasing the level of awareness and knowledge about the basic biological or neurobiological roots of migraine, which is clearly both a biochemical, neurological, and electrical phenomenon that's involved in the brain.
Okay, so scientists are pretty sure now that migraines are caused by electrical or biochemical processes within the brain, yes?
Both electrical and biochemical changes in the brain involving, at least on some levels, these chemical messengers in the brain that we call neurotransmitters.
Now, what would set this off?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Number one, it seems that patients with migraine have more excitability of nerve activity in their brain, and they're more prone to having this process set off. We know genetics and families play a big role in this. 70 to 90% of people with migraine have a first-degree relative of it, with it. Now, we know that there are certain triggers that can ignite this process, and there are a whole host of triggers. Exactly how they do it, we're not sure about. But we know that hormone certainly is a key factor in women. We know that diet can play a role. We know that changes in one's external or internal environment, external like weather, seasons, time zones, schedule changes, things of that sort.
And we'll get to more of those triggers in more detail a little later in our conversation. Now, a lot of people assume that people who are prone to bad headaches are just incredibly neurotic, and that's why they get them. So the more we know about brain chemistry, can we rule out the neurotic stuff?
I think so. I think, why don't we say the same things about people who develop ulcers or asthma or ulcerative colitis or angina or heart disease or hypertension or diabetes? You know, there's no disorder in the world where stress and psychological factors can't play a role. I can't think of any. For example, diabetics. When diabetics go through times of physical or emotional stress, their insulin requirements change. It's no less or more true of a disorder like migraine. And I think that's been a really bad rap that people with migraine have gotten over the years. I've spoken to people whose children, for example, have an aggressive version of migraine called chronic daily headache, who even relatives and friends have said, well, your 28-year-old daughter just won't grow up, and that's the issue, as if people are using this horrible pain as some kind of excuse. Now, there's no question that people who happen to have, side-by-side with migraine, major psychological problems, that those problems don't affect their disorder. But again, that's true of everything else. I think in that sense, people with migraine, particularly women, have really been maligned as far as that's concerned. And especially women can't win.
What's new in the realm of pain relief now that scientists believe more and more that headaches are caused by electrical and biochemical changes in the brain? Are there any new drugs that address those changes within the brain?
Well, as we've identified a part of the migraine process, which involves a very important nerve in the head, the fifth nerve or trigeminal nerve, which is named such because it has three divisions, we're beginning to identify more of the receptors and more of the biochemicals in the brain that appear to be involved with migraine. Now, Imitrex or sumatriptan was developed on the basis of some of those receptors which involve serotonin. A lot more work has been done to identify other types of medication that will be coming out over the next several years that will also be similar to Imitrex, but perhaps quicker acting, longer acting, less side effects. But as we look at other receptors that don't involve changes in blood vessels, but that can reverse the migraine process, we'll be coming on to medications that have the potential for greater safety and less side effects. And so the research that's being done worldwide, and particularly by Mike Moskowitz at Harvard, has been nothing short of excellent in terms of what the future will bring for migraine patients. We're also looking at pain receptors in the brain. We're looking at pain medications that may be helpful in reversing pain without causing the problems of tolerance or addiction, because there are different pain receptors up there as well. Most people are familiar with what's called mu receptors or morphine-like receptors, but there are other receptors that can affect pain that don't involve becoming dependent or addicted to medication, and those are being explored now.
Let's just review some of the things we talked a little bit about the last time, like what the difference is between a migraine headache and a tension headache, and, you know, does it matter if they're any different? I mean, do you need to know which kind you have?
I think so. I think that the diagnosis of the headache is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Very basically, we explain to our patients that we can divide all of headache problems into two major categories, what we've called primary and what we call secondary headache disorders. The secondary headache disorders, Terry, are the ones that are a symptom of some underlying medical problem where you can find the cause, identify it, and then hopefully remove the cause and then the headache. Now, the more serious causes are the ones that people start to worry about when they first get these headache problems, like tumors and bleeds and aneurysms, to less ominous problems such as sinus problems, dental problems, eye problems, and allergy problems. But there are many other medical problems like diabetes. There are many medications that can cause headache as a side effect. You want to rule those things out first because, if possible, you want to remove the cause and be able to then actually really realize a cure. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it, most headache disorders and most people with recurrent headache problems have one or more of the primary headache disorders. The primary headache disorders are by far the most common cause of recurrent headache in over 90% of people.
In other words, most people don't really have brain tumors when they have a bad headache.
Oh, thank goodness, no. They have headaches that are related to some of the biochemical issues that we were just discussing earlier. The three types of primary headache disorders are migraine, tension-type headache, and cluster.
And what's the difference?
Well, the difference is important because depending on the diagnosis, that's what you base treatment on. Migraine, we have very specific criteria for now. First of all, you've had to have had at least 5 previous episodes of this kind of pain. The pain generally lasts 4 to 72 hours, and you want to have ruled out organic factors like tumors, which may sometimes mimic migraine. Once you have that, we then look at 2 groups of symptoms, 2 from column A and 1 from column B. Here's column A. There are 4 symptoms here. The pain is one-sided, the pain is throbbing, the pain is moderate to severe and can interfere with or completely restrict your ability to function, and 4th, activity makes the headache worse, like exercise. For example, if I say to a patient with migraine, "Would you exercise during a migraine?" they look at me like I'm completely out of my mind, and at that point I know I have the diagnosis clinched. So you need 2 of those and 1 of the following: the presence of nausea, the presence of vomiting, or sensitivity to both light and sound. So traditionally, the migraine patient will absolutely retreat to a dark and quiet room, avoid all sensory stimuli. Even the light from a clock radio can send shivers of pain through their bodies, and the least little sound will bother them as well. So they want to hibernate, and they want to sleep if they can. Actually, for centuries, we've known that sleep is an age-old, tried-and-true relief factor for migraine, and it probably relates to changes in serotonin that are brought on by sleep, where serotonin is restored as you go to sleep. So that's what migraine is, and it's a very debilitating disorder, affecting women three times more frequently than men. Actually, before puberty, though, it's more frequent in boys than girls. But as soon as hormonal issues become a problem, it goes up 3 to 1.
Now, how does migraine compare with what you'd call tension headache?
Well, I would say for the most part, in terms of the intensity of the pain and the associated symptoms of nausea and vomiting, it doesn't compare. And that's one of the reasons that migraine patients have felt abandoned and isolated and merely misunderstood. They really feel kind of apart from everybody else, because when they say the word headache, most people assume it's like the ordinary tension headaches that all of us get from time to time. 90 to 95% of us will have a headache from time to time. Tension headaches are mild to moderate, really, at best. It's more of a squeezing pain. It's more both-sided. It's more of an aching feeling that we may feel as a band around our head, or we may feel a cap-like sensation. It may go down to our neck and shoulders. There's no nausea. There's no vomiting. There's no sensitivity to both light and sound. Most people can function, though maybe at a little reduced capacity, and they relax or take an over-the-counter medication, and that's it. But you don't call into work. What happens if you call into work and you say to your boss, gee, I'm sorry, I can't come in today. I have a headache. What kind of response do you think you're going to get? Not a very good one. So migraine and tension type headache, though, are both classified as headache disorders. They are in absolutely two different worlds. They're galaxies apart.
My guest is headache expert Dr. Fred Cheftel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Fred Cheftel. He's co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and he's also the national president of the American Council for Headache Education. And his latest book is Headache Relief for Women. If you're trying to get a sense for yourself of whether you should be taking a prescription migraine medicine or whether over-the-counter remedies are good enough for you, how can you judge?
Well, I think you can judge, again, in terms of are you missing work? Are you missing time from work? Are you not functioning? Do you have to cancel social engagements? Are you afraid of upcoming social engagements or business commitments? You know, if that's the picture and you find that your over-the-counter medication may take the edge off of a little bit, but you find that you're using it over several days to just kind of take the edge off but still feeling pretty lousy, I think you ought to talk to your doctor about more specific remedies that we have available for these disorders, and there certainly are many nowadays.
Now, name a couple of the prescription remedies that you think are good and don't have a lot of side effects.
Okay. Well, first of all, in looking at the acute treatment of headache after you've made your diagnosis of migraine or tension-type headache, or cluster for that matter, start what I would call step care therapy. Most of the time, by the time people have seen us, they've used over-the-counter medications without success, as we've just spoken about. But if you're looking at OTC medication, we can divide them up into simple analgesics or simple pain medications and the ones that are combined. The simple ones are single-ingredient medications. Those are Tylenol, Advil, Aleve, Arutis, aspirin. If those don't help you, you might consider a combined ingredient, which is Anacin, which has caffeine and aspirin, or Excedrin, which has caffeine, aspirin, and Tylenol in it. If those have not helped, then we go on to the more powerful medications, and I like to start again with the mildest. One of the medications that's very, very useful for both migraine and tension-type headache with minimal side effects is a medicine called Midrin. It has a couple of ingredients in it. It has Tylenol, a mild muscle relaxant in it, and something that helps to constrict blood vessels. And we use a lot of Midrin and find that to be very helpful and very well tolerated. It's an excellent medication for childhood migraine. Again, with children and migraine, you want to stay away from aspirin products because of Reye's syndrome, but you can use the Tylenol-type products. After Midrin, there's very useful medications that are well-tolerated that contain a mixture of either aspirin or Tylenol plus a little caffeine plus butalbital or barbiturate. These medications have been around now for almost 50 years. They're very safe to use. They go by the brand names of Furanol, Furoset, or Estric. Now, these medications are useful. The problem with them, again, is them being overprescribed. I have seen really ridiculous prescriptions written for huge amounts of these medications, and patients don't know what to do with them and inadvertently start to overuse them and then come to us basically addicted. But if you use these medications occasionally, they can be excellent. Then there's a whole group of prescription non-steroidals, which if you don't have ulcer or hypertension, are very, very well tolerated. They go by the names of Anaprox or Naprosyn or Meclamin or Ansaid, and they can be very useful for both migraine and or tension-type headache. Even the simple narcotics, again used occasionally, like Tylenol with codeine, can be very helpful. It's the fact when you use these products too often that it's a problem.
Well, I remember the last time we talked, you talked about something called the rebound headache.
Right.
Which means if you take over-the-counter, over-the-shelf, medication too often, that it can almost reinforce that headache pattern. And ever since then, every time I reach for a painkiller, you know, aspirin or Tylenol, I'm thinking, uh-oh, am I going to get a rebound headache? Am I taking too much or am I under the threshold? So tell us what the rebound headache is and give us some guidelines.
Okay, the rebound headache occurs, there's about 3% of the population that has something called chronic daily headache. 80% of those people are overusing analgesic or pain-killing medication, be it by prescription or non-prescription. Two things happen. One, it absolutely will make the headache continue to be chronic, and two, it will get in the way of any non-medication or medication approach from working, and that's a problem. You really are trading in some short-term relief for keeping that disorder going. The pain of rebound is characterized by a waxing and waning pain that's there from practically morning till night, mild to moderate, and usually most of these patients have superimposed episodes of more severe headaches, which turn out to be migraine. So my advice is this. If you find yourself using the over-the-counter medications three or more times per week, or if you find that your headaches are significantly interfering with the quality of your life at work, home, and play, if you can't leave your house without a bottle of some over-the-counter medication in your purse or in your pocket,
yes.
I think then you might want to talk to your doctor about other approaches to it. So I think three or more times a week is when people should start to think about talking to their doctor about headaches. And by the way, one of the things we've known from some studies that have been done is that patients with headache do not even mention their headache to the primary care doctor until the last 2 minutes of their visit. And we know that a lot of patients bring up some of the most important things that they need to talk about at the end of the visit, so headache is then given short shrift. Advice to the listener. When you come into your doctor, if you have headaches that are bothering you, please bring it up at the front end of that interview or that visit. Let your doctor know that your headaches are bothering you. My advice to doctors in terms of interviewing patients who have headache is the first question they should ask is, do your headaches interfere with the quality of your life? Then if you get an answer, yes, they do. I'm taking non-prescription medications every day. Three times a month, I get so bad that I'm not able to work or take care of my responsibilities at home. At least the doctor now hears that you have a serious complaint. So don't add to what I would call the trivialization of headache by both physicians and the media.
My guest is headache expert Dr. Fred Cheftel. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Fred Schaftel, and he is the co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and he's also the president of the American Council for Headache Education. He's co-author of the new book, Headache Relief for Women. Now, your new book contains a lot of information about menstrual cycles and headaches and pregnancy and headaches and so on. So let's get into some of that. How does headache relate to a woman's hormone levels?
Well, as we've known, clearly the ratio in migraine goes up 3-to-1 after puberty. It's really because of the nature of cyclical estrogens. During a woman's normal hormonal cycle, estrogens go up and down. Now, estrogens can have an indirect effect on blood vessel activity, and it's really clear now that the changing levels of estrogen also have an effect on brain chemistry, and when they are falling, it can increase susceptibility to incoming pain stimuli. Well, we've known from studies from years ago that it's the fall of estrogen, which occurs premenstrually and to some extent during ovulation, that can make women who have a vulnerability for migraine susceptible to it at that time. We know, for example, that during pregnancy, Terry, that 75% of women with migraine feel great. Why is that? The reason is that during pregnancy, going into your fourth month, estrogens are sustained at a high level. They do not fluctuate. Then you talk about going into menopause, and around menopause, there are more fluctuations around the perimenopausal area involving estrogen and progesterone that can affect the woman adversely. Then you talk about the issue of hormone replacement. That's controversial enough, but there are ways of replacing hormones in migrainous women that will make them worse and ways of replacing it that make them better. Unfortunately, too many OBGYN doctors are not necessarily sensitive to the issue of migraine. They don't truly understand how debilitating it can be, and they replace estrogens the way they do for non-migrainous women, and that can be a disaster.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is this, is that most of the time the way estrogens are replaced postmenopausally is kind of mimicking the menstrual cycle. So you're put on estrogen, for example, Premarin, Estrace, the estrogen patch, days 1 through 21 or 1 through 25. And then you put on progesterone someplace in there as well, either days 1 through 10 or 15 through 25. Every woman who's on the cyclical replacement with migraine dreads going on the progesterone because they know when they go on that, the likelihood is they're going to get killed as far as migraine is concerned. So the problem is that women who still have their uteri intact really need to take progesterone to protect them against the cancer potential of the estrogens as far as the uterus is concerned. So here's the way we do it. If you have your uterus intact, we recommend that the estrogens be given on a daily basis, that they not be cycled. We also recommend that the progesterone be given in smaller doses on a daily basis as well. It gives you the advantage of the protection you need, and it also gives you the advantage of stopping the cycling, which is the major issue. Sometimes you may need to switch to different types of hormone replacement if you find that your headaches are not doing well with the first type. And OBGYN people have to be open to listening to that. And I usually give our women patients articles to give to their gynecologist. And I find at that point the gynecologist is more open to looking at the issue and is generally very receptive to making the changes that we suggest based on all the literature on estrogens, progesterones, and women.
If a woman's headaches seem to be related to changes in hormones during her menstrual cycle or related to menopause, does that mean she should be treating her headache differently than other people?
Yes, to some extent. And the reason is this, is we know that the migraines that are associated directly with the menstrual cycle are more difficult to treat by and large than those not associated with the cycle. Even the same woman, her non-menstrual attacks respond much better to medication than her menstrual attacks. There's some evidence that medicines like Imitrex seem to work as well during the menstrual cycle. Now, because it involves hormones, Terry, there are some subtle things that one can do around that time of the month hormonally that may be helpful and not dangerous. For example, I said that the reason that women are prone to these headaches around the period is related to falling estrogen. We may put them on a very, very tiny dose of the estrogen patch around their period. which doesn't really affect their period, but prevents the estrogens from falling and can really delay the headache or even prevent it from occurring. So there are some special maneuvers around menses time that can be done. Sometimes we may just use a non-steroidal medication like Anaprox a couple of times a day going into the period once we have that headache timed, and that can be helpful. So there are some perimenstrual regimens that are available, and we talk about them in the book as well.
I want to look at some non-drug-oriented ways of dealing with headache. Now, tell me what kind of success you've had with these things, a massage, acupuncture, hypnosis, biofeedback.
We've had varying degrees of success with all of those modalities, but I think what people have to understand is that, you know, they'll talk to other patients who say, oh, hypnosis did it for me, oh, acupuncture did it for me. Unfortunately, the same modality does not work for every given person. So we're open to trying a variety of these things. We need to combine both pharmacological and non-pharmacological approaches. Acupuncture and acupressure can be helpful for some. Self-hypnosis, relaxation, biofeedback can be helpful for others. Exercise, diet manipulation, vitamins. There are certain vitamins and herbs that can be helpful for some patients. And we like patients to really try to use a potpourri of these non-pharmacological approaches as well.
Dr. Fred Cheftel is the co-founder of the New England Center for Headache in Stamford, Connecticut, and national president of AACE, the American Council for Headache Education. His latest book is Headache Relief for Women. Our interview was recorded last February. Our series on the body and the mind concludes tomorrow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Roberta Shurrock. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Cherie Gross. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.